but that spend might have resulted in a strategic move or one of the best returns that the business could have done in the year. So it's more so about each isolated decision rather than a target budget.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at procurementexpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got fellow Irishman, Shane Spellman. I presume he's Irish. Actually, I haven't checked, but he's got an Irish accent anyway, from Spellman Profit Partners. And Shane has got a case study to bring with him today about how his years of experience on the buy side working for one of Ireland's largest corporates managing their M&A decisions is now being brought to benefit for SMBs who are maybe considering selling their business or beyond that, just in the everyday operations as a fractional CFO. So Shane, you're very welcome to the podcast. Maybe you can kick things off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Thank you very much, James. Well, I am Irish. You were right. Good presumption. Something that people wouldn't know, your listeners may not know. Anyone that knows me probably does know it because I like to indulge myself in a lot of cycle racing. So cycling is a big part of my life. After my three kids, cycling plays a big role. Keeps me fit, keeps me active. So when I haven't got my head stuck in a business or in a spreadsheet, I'm stuck in the middle of a peloton trying to keep up with athletes who are about half my age and much fitter than me. So that's my passion.
So sometimes I think there's like a prototype for different sports. Like when I think of sailors, I think of a certain type. When I think of rugby players, I think of a type. What would you say are the personality characteristics of your typical cyclist that marks them out?
I'm probably not going to paint them in the best light, but a fanatic,
that's okay.
Someone who's really data focused, to link it to a fractional CFO, someone who's data focused, performance focused, but it is quite a technical sport, but it's most definitely about performance and personal performance. I think that probably summarizes it. And I found racing in particular, different to running or maybe triathlon, but cycle racing in particular is ultra competitive.
Yeah, I get the impression there's no hiding. Like you're as good as the numbers say, and that's it. And there's no point in trying to fudge the thing. It's totally brutal in that way.
100%. I mean, if you're a rower on a boat, you've got the other rowers to row with you and you're part of a team. If you're on a football or a field sport, again, you've got other members of the team if you're having a bad day. Not the case when it's cycling. I can testify to that. You know, being dropped out of a bunch or a peloton, once you're dropped, it's almost cumulative. So, you know, you lose that aerodynamic benefit of being in the bunch. And once you're out the back, you're on your own. And it's essentially a multiple harder to keep up. So it's, absolutely, as you said, no place for hiding.
Good. Okay. So we're going to talk today about how you helped a client save or capture, let's say, $500,000 worth of extra value when they came to selling their business. And we're also going to talk about how to make this investment decisions for SMBs as well. But before we do that, let's establish your credentials here. Maybe you could tell us briefly about your career, how you got qualified, and what's been your biggest commercial success so far.
Yeah, sure. So I majored in accounting in my undergraduate and I went on to study a master's in financial services. I suppose I wanted a twist on accounting or something as an add-on, and financial services I was interested in. It was the flavor of the day back in 2006, pre-bubble bust. But I went into the financial services route and essentially went into banking. I joined Bank of Ireland on a graduate program. Very, very interesting graduate program at the time. I moved around to the different areas of the bank, including wealth management, the trading desk, etc., which, as I said, during the financial crisis was a very tough time, but a very interesting time. Learned a lot there. But accountancy did call me back, and I moved across a number of different financial services firms throughout my early career and ended up in a lot of different management reporting style roles across financial services.
So financial services seems to be a fairly broad term. Normally when I meet someone in financial services, about 10 minutes later, they're trying to sell me a pension. So I guess, is it a sales role? What does it really mean to be in financial services? In the role you were in corporate?
You're right. Sometimes I find that, you know, finance can mean different things to different people. I guess there's business finance and there's personal finance, but financial services in this context meant everything from a banking organization to an insurance organization. Worked with Aviva and MetLife. And in those roles, it was a financial servicing company, but it was a move towards more practical accounting type roles. So it was management reporting for financial service industry.
Okay. So what's interesting in your career, what stuck out for me, is your move to Kerry Group, where you eventually rose to become the lead. Sorry, I'm going to get the terminology wrong, but you were responsible for helping the board decide upon hundreds of millions of dollars worth of investment decisions every year. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it was a very unusual role. It was a return on investment lead. So essentially, you were the one that was worth supporting those decisions that the organization made. Kerry Group, they're an Irish company based in Ireland, but they are a multinational company. They're in the nutrition. They were in ingredients, but the taste and nutrition field. Essentially, they had a capital policy and an acquisition policy. The board had responsibility for deciding on those policies, as well as the management before it got to board. And my role was to ensure that return on investment was key and paramount to those decisions. So it was about helping management in the first instance prioritize those decisions and helping present those decisions as best as possible to the board. They had a capital spend at the time of more than 300 million, and they had an acquisition budget that varied from year to year, but was probably a multiple of that, including simple bolt-on acquisitions and more significant acquisitions as well.
And when it sounds like there was a budget almost for, seems weird. So which comes first, like the budget and the decision to grow by acquisition, or the opportunistic? Is it something that you opportunistically find these ways to expand the business, or is it a particular strategy to say, okay, we're going to try and spend X amount, and then there's a job around trying to generate those opportunities?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's probably not a straightforward answer, but you could split it into two and say that M&A was probably more in terms of opportunistic. So it was always about the right deal. And that, as you said, was linked to strategy. So Kerry Group strategy at the time was focus on bolt-on acquisitions that added significant value, get into new areas of food technology that they weren't in previously. But on the capital side, I suppose from a CapEx point of view, each project was a good idea standalone. So you could justify anything. However, it was when you brought those projects together, and a long list of projects they were, you could probably come up with over $1 billion in spend easily. Now, that wasn't going to happen in any one year. So it's about how do you prioritize those? Will you prioritize them in terms of payback or return on investment, hence the role? And you also link them to strategy as well. So at the time, I was involved in creating a ranking policy for each of those projects to ensure that the ones with the best return and the best strategic link came to the top.
Okay, so Kerry Group, from the name, I'm guessing there was a range of CEOs or a number of companies under that, and they were all pitching effectively for CapEx from the mothership, and you were the one who helped corral all those opportunities and decide what had to go.
Exactly, so a limited resource being cash, and each one vying for that limited resource. Each one pitching their own projects, as I said, all really good projects standalone, but it's when you bring those together from a strategic perspective, which were the right ones for the direction of the company at the time.
And I want to briefly touch on some of them were, you know, I guess a straight up ROI, and some of them were related to maybe DEI initiatives and things which are harder to define return, I guess. So how would you put metrics around? I can kind of understand where you deploy capital to get more cash flow, and that makes sense. But you also had to consider projects which necessarily wouldn't bring more cash flow, but might be a more holistic value to the business. How do you go about putting a number around that? Or how did you go about deciding whether hard cash is worth doing for some of these, I don't want to say woolier metrics, but you know, things that are required, DEI and so on?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very easy to calculate a return for a new manufacturing line. You know exactly what it's going to manufacture in a year. You know if you're at capacity and you've got additional sales to run through that line, you know what it's going to return, you know what it's going to do, and you're fairly certain on the cost, so it's easy to calculate a payback. You're right, that becomes more difficult when you move outside of a typical manufacturing base and you move into other type of investments. And I actually, during my time in Kerry Group, left the return on investment role and moved into a business partnering role. So I partnered with various areas within the business, including HR, which was a huge learning for me after coming from a very technical area, such as capital and return on investment, to a very non-numerate and human area, being human resources. It was a significant difference. Obviously, the challenge was, as you had called out there, putting value and putting return on something that seemed a little intangible, if you like. But there are ways and means to do it.
So it sounds like you had to advocate for then HR training, development resources, and so on like that. And what was your most effective way to advocate for that sort of thing? Because training HR, it's always a bit of a, you don't know what you're going to get. Yeah, we can invest in this, but you know, it's hard to tell. So what was the best way to explain that to someone with a finance mind that yes, this HR investment is going to pay off?
Yeah, with great difficulty initially, because as I said, coming from a very technical background, some of the calculations were quite easily done. When you move away from what I would refer to that direct return and to a more indirect return, well, how do you put metrics on that? One example, you mentioned learning and development. That was one area we did actually quite a lot on in terms of getting an investment in the strategic plan. But one good example was around talent acquisition, where you look at maybe investing in talent acquisition, whether that's personnel or systems, et cetera. One of the metrics talent acquisition look at is empty chair time. So we looked at empty chair time, that time between someone leaves the business and it takes us to fill that role. Now, that might not necessarily be just when there's nobody in the role. That might be the ramp up of the next person. So that can relate to the efficiency of talent acquisition, or it can relate to the attention, the retention metrics of the business. It's easy, but a cost. It's easier to put a cost on that. And then the question is, can your investment move the dial on that? If it can, then you're in payback territory, albeit indirect. It becomes very difficult to track to the bottom line. However, in tracking the metric itself, i.e. in this case, empty chair time, you can essentially work out whether you were successful in that investment. And sometimes the most important thing with these, what I'm noticing in particular in the SMB market today and the clients I work with, is not necessarily the decision up front of whether something's going to pay back or not. It's tracking it after the fact to ensure that everyone is held accountable.
Right. Okay. Into chair time. That's very interesting. So I've never thought of that before. So Shane, being responsible for being involved with many M&A deals on the buy side, what have you learned there in terms of mistakes that sellers can make in not capturing all the value that's on the table?
I suppose there's three key areas. One is the strategy to ensure that the acquisition is a good strategic fit. Another is on synergies. So to ensure that any synergies that have been designated or outlined are actually achievable. And that probably relates more so to integration. And then thirdly is on the due diligence, that very painstaking process that is really important. I have seen mistakes in the past where, for example, a buyer may have looked at a business, looked at their pension scheme and not factored in the real cost of a pension. And within devils in the detail on these ones, where a defined, what was seen as a defined contribution scheme actually related more so to a defined benefit scheme and ended up with a significant cost to the buyer. Being on the sell side, you're then prepared for that and you're coming at it with a different lens, but having those learnings in the past or more recently, there was a deal where I suppose there's two parts to any deal. One is the economic value and the other is the cash value that the sellers receive. And the economic value is essentially a multiple of the profit, and the cash value is anything they have earned in the past or up to the completion date. There was one particular piece which was a little complex, but while working for my client as a fractional CFO on the deal, noted that there was a piece that they had earned, which was essentially a cash-like item that they should have received as cash. And on the paper, you could see the value of that being in the region of 500,000. So all of a sudden you're seeing very immediately and very definitively what value you're adding. There was me being the fractional CFO for that business. There wasn't anyone else that was going to identify that. Obviously, the buyers aren't going to call it out. So it was nice to see a good return on their investment.
Okay. So, I mean, what I heard there was the prototypical SMB owner, SME owner, is a sort of maybe came up in sales, full of energy, not always amazing attention to detail, not always amazing. They create these things amazingly through sheer force of will and personality sometimes. But then you get into the stage where in the acquisition, probably the biggest deal they've ever been a part of, it's a long drawn out process. They're maybe not used to enterprise sales. They're not used to a lot of these things. It might be a consumer style business. And this is where, this is where someone who's used to these type of deals, you need to get them on your side because it's too risky to try and do it by yourself effectively. So your transition to working with smaller businesses, what's been the biggest surprise, pleasant and unpleasant surprise about going from corporate to SMB?
Yeah, as mentioned, it is significant differences. I like to think you take the best of both worlds. The value add is the big piece. You can see the value that you add very immediately, that there being a good example. The personalities that you deal with, I was always one for truth and honesty. And I think that stands me really well when it comes to working with SMBs and owners. You know, they want a direct answer. They want a simplified answer. And they also want that backed by detail. Now, they might not go into the detail, but that's where they rely and trust on you to have done your work and to provide them a story that is immediate, that's relevant, and that's real time as well. Probably the biggest personality differences is moving away from the more bureaucratic political style that you might get in corporates to a more entrepreneurial-led business, which is great. It's fast, it's nimble, but it also might be a little lacking focus. And it works across a number of clients to varying degrees, but there's one particular client where many opportunities, fantastic business, great growth, had moved from a one-man style show to a business that had grown very quickly, very fast, and probably had got a little too big for that one individual to manage. A number of different employees, but more so, you know, on the face employees. That's where I come in and try to help prioritize, linking back to that capital investment. Anything can be justified standalone, but what is the best thing to do and what's the best thing to do immediately? In my view, there's two limiting resources. The first one, we always think about it as accountants, and that is cash. And cash is king, absolutely. And cash can be a limiting resource. But if you have a business that may be a little more cash rich, cash isn't an issue, then what is the other one? Now, the other limiting resource is, I like to call it, time and or energy, because both are interlinked. So even if you have the cash to do something, you don't have the time or energy to do everything. And it goes back to that old saying, you can do anything, but not everything. So the challenge then was to focus the mind and focus the team as to which one to do next. It was almost like a bottleneck. Everything was jammed going into one place and nothing was actually making progress. To list out those items, look at the one that's going to return the fastest, that is going to return the most, and that is most linked to the strategy of the business, in this case, the SMB. So not very unlike the capital ranking process that I had mentioned a little earlier, just more nuanced.
So in an entrepreneurial style business, lots of things get started, not as many things get finished, which I think, if we could boil it off, is kind of the problem, you know, for a lot of us. But then when you come into a business and you're trying to get people to prioritize, because these people are just full of energy and you say, yeah, they agree one thing with you, if I know them, and then they go off and they do something else, and then you come back and you have your next meeting. And how do you actually communicate that? How do you get them to stay focused when they naturally, you know, have learned all their business career that you succeed by sheer energy and doing all sorts of things, you know?
Absolutely. And it serves them really well to that point. So the best is to bring it to life on the bottom line and true numbers, which is what a fractional CFO is. It's their bread and butter, really. So, you know, let's take an example. A construction company, significant growth over a number of years, many different opportunities to grow further in terms of the top line on sales. but also an opportunity to become more efficient in the growth that they had. It was an easy one for me to look at both of those. So do we grow our product line and increase sales, or do we look at efficiency? Well, again, both can be justified and both are really good options. I wouldn't say no to either. And my client, business owner, wouldn't like me to say no to either, because they definitely wouldn't. But which do we do first? The one with the fastest payback and the one with the most control is the efficiency, because that is within our control. Sales, you can, as you probably know, you can add a lot of time and energy and cash, and they just may not vest, or they may do, but they may take time to do. So the best one was the efficiency. And what I did was to inform that decision, was play that out in numbers. Here's what we need to invest. Here's what it would mean in terms of the bottom line. And here's when it'll pay back. Here's the same on the sales one. But, you know, there are some uncertainties there in terms of what we can control, what we will achieve. We're making assumptions. And as you know, you have revenue dreams and expense realities. So the one where there was most control, most certainty, was the one in efficiency. We focused on that over a number of months, and it's still in progress, but it's making good progress.
Okay, awesome. Ding-a-ling-a-ling. We're talking about cost control, I think, right in my wheelhouse. So I guess what I heard there was you can be guaranteed that you can control your costs, or you can improve efficiencies there. And what are your, in this instance here, what's the go-to move? Do you look at supplier rationalization or rebates, or just shopping around, or just what's the low-hanging fruit for people? Because let's face it, cost control, people don't get as excited about that as they do with the shiny big new customer they could potentially have or whatever. So do you have a set of things that you look for straight away to try and add to the bottom line?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a few. In that particular example, it was about working with the resources that the business had and just making them more efficient, essentially. What you talk about there is cost control. So that might be looking at your overheads and saying, right, where have we got the biggest increase, or which part of our overheads is the biggest portion of our total? That's where a good procurement process would come in. And most importantly, someone who has direct responsibility for those overheads. You'll normally find that in a business, you know, you've got someone on sales, you've got someone on ops, but where are overheads managed? Is it the business owner? Is it the COO? Is it the CFO? Just having a person, regardless of who it is, who's responsible for them, gives that direct accountability.
So very tactically then, does that one person that I like own the one credit card or the one ordering system, or like today, like very tactically, how do you get to a situation where people are used to just ringing up suppliers, ordering what they need to get the job done and so on? How do you put control around that?
I don't think so. I think it's a culture. So, you know, what you mentioned there, if it was the CFO, let's say it's me responsible for overheads. Well, that's a really typical accountancy type role where you come in and you say, don't spend anymore. That's not going to work. Someone in control of the credit cards, the owner, or in control of maybe signing off on each expense, the owner, that just creates a bottleneck and a headache for the owner. It also reduces the flexibility of the business, it slows things down. It's more so there's accountability for one person responsible for them, but there's responsibility for multiple people. Anyone with, you know, a cost or an account management that go out and procure those goods, they're each responsible. And then that's where it becomes more of a culture, a way of thinking. If it is the CFO or anyone, whoever it is, who is accountable for them, then it's that person who is accountable to ensure that each person that goes out and procures those items around payback, resourcing, etc.
So, I mean, practically then, is your CFO coming up with a budget and then putting that to department heads, or, you know, and then having them control, sign off on each of those expenses? Is that the way that plays out?
That is the typical way. It might not be suitable in every business. I think what is much more reasonable is to have a business budget and to have each of the heads responsible for each of their own spend. That way it's a bottom-up type culture.
Okay. So I don't really get the difference here. So what's a business budget versus a budget that you...
If you had a budget, yeah, let's say you've got multiple business units or you've got multiple areas within your business, you would break each of those areas down, hand them a budget, and say that is your budget for the year. Spend no more, spend no less, which is the traditional way of doing it. But it doesn't always end up in the best use of spend. Yeah, you've obviously heard the phrase, use it or lose it. And there's definitely that type of a feeling. So what you might get is someone on both sides of the coin, you might get an area in the business spending what they have in any given year because it's there to spend. Or equally, you might get an area in the business not spending more than their budget because they don't want to be over budget. But that spend might have resulted in a strategic move or one of the best returns that the business could have done in the year. So it's more so about each isolated decision rather than a target budget.
Well, this brings us back a bit. I mean, ideally, there would be a return on every spend and you could track it. And if people could focus on the return rather than the spend, then that would sort of make it all come good, right? So, but it's tricky to do, easy to do maybe for sales.
Exactly. It's difficult. Yeah, it's absolutely easy for sales. Difficult to, it's more so mentality. But that would be what a fractional CFO would be accountable for, ensuring that type of mentality is growing within the business and each person is taking their own responsibility in doing their part. And as you said, it doesn't matter if it's a euro or 100,000 euro. If there's no return, it's a bad spend. And equally vice versa, if it returns, it doesn't matter what value it's at.
Great. So maybe we could wrap things up by telling us a bit about your ideal customer to work with today, geographically, company size-wise, you know, industries.
Yeah, not really industry specific, but in terms of size, there could be a company that's growing, significant growth, a startup, etc. But outside of those kind of unique examples, you're probably looking at revenue of anywhere from 5 to 50 million. When there has been significant growth, that's usually a good opportunity. They have grown, they've pushed it through the top line, they've got the sales, maybe they've got the span, but there isn't that focus on either the bottom line profit or on cash and cash management. That's usually the sweet spot because that's where a CFO can come in, add that value, provide that expertise, but not at the cost of a full-time CFO.
Very good. And what's the best way to reach out to you, Shane?
You can get me on email, shane@spellmanprofitpartners. That's SPELLMAN, profit with an F, not with a PH. That's a different game. So profitpartners.ie, or you can get me on my website at that same address.
Very good. Thank you. And thank you for listening. If you got this far into the podcast, your special reward, if you're a fractional CFO, just like Shane, we run monthly fractional CFO masterminds. You get to come along, you get put into a group with three or four other fractional CFOs, and you get to brainstorm challenges that either in your practice or your clients might be having, and get feedback from your peers. So you can sign up for that at procurementexpress.com/CFO mastermind. And that's it. Thanks for coming along, Shane. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Great talk to James. Thank you.